Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't
care.
I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, powered by FoxBet. College football, I think it's week 11. I'm not quite sure anymore. They all blend together. I am your host, Todd Furman, joined, as always, by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only Payne Insider.
Week 12. Week 12. Here we go.
You can see the finish line. I mean, is the light go on in Payne Insider going, I can see the finish line. To that, you know, I have 1/8 of a mile left to finish the marathon.
Something like that. Although college football has been somewhat pleasant this year.
Yes, it has. No complaints in that particular regard. And we, of course, have five big games that we will get to before we bid everyone a fond farewell. Real quick, though, Payne, we had another release of the college football playoff last night. A little adjustment at the top. LSU obviously moves to number one with their big win against Alabama. Ohio State number two, Clemson three, Georgia four. And oh, looky, looky, Alabama number five. Basically, the committee telling us Alabama may not have to have a single resume building win, but they'll get an inside track to yet another berth in the college football playoff.
That question sounded awfully salty.
Here's my take, and I'm going to go on a very brief.
I knew you had one. That's why I led you.
Here we go. It's a very brief rant in all of it. I have no problem acknowledging the fact that Alabama is one of the top four teams in the country as far as overall talent. Their resume is not indicative of a team that will be top four, assuming that they win out and they beat Mississippi State this weekend, they beat the college football powerhouse known as Western Carolina, and they go on the road and beat Auburn. You finish the regular season 11-1. In my opinion, that doesn't warrant inclusion over a 12-1 potential conference champion somewhere else in a Power 5 league. If we want to talk about power ratings and we want the best four teams, then fine, put Alabama in there, but then don't tell me last year and justify Notre Dame because they ran the table as one of the four best teams. Is it best teams? Is it most deserving? The committee's got to make up their damn mind.
You sound like you have an Oregon ticket in your pocket.
I may or may not have an Oregon ticket in my pocket, but I am debating an Alabama ticket at the current price, knowing that Alabama is essentially in control of their own destiny, and given my feelings for Georgia's upcoming schedule.
I got to tell you, through about 2 minutes here, I feel like Brian Flores and you're Brian Hoyer. My man pretty well. It's always difficult.
Does that mean I'm going to put up a goose egg in the first half? Is that what you're going to tell me? I'm going to go out there, put up a goose egg and absolutely embarrass myself? Thanks, buddy. I appreciate the love and support.
No, I mean, I just kind of knew your opinions and thoughts on these things. So I wanted to lead you at the start of the show. But to your point, we still have Ohio State number one, LSU two, Clemson three, Bama four in terms of our power ratings, Georgia five, Oklahoma slightly behind. We don't have Oregon in the top 10.
I'm with you. Hey, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying Oregon's a top 10 team by any stretch of the imagination. I just want some transparency and consistency for how they go about seeding the field. And I don't care if it's Oregon that gets in Alabama, it is what it is. But I just want to know that this process rewards teams for going out there and playing somebody when you look at some of the strength of schedule, non-conference, and is it the best? Is it the most deserving? And I think that's where the distinction has to be made with this, not only for this season, but also going forward.
What they're just going to end up doing is just adding more teams, unfortunately. Well, I think that's probably going to be their Band-Aid of sorts. And it's always tough in college football, right? You play all these unbalanced schedules. And that's why we're constantly talking about schedule when we're breaking these games down, because it is so unbalanced. I don't know the right way. There clearly has to be a human element, a common sense element that says, hey, sure, we want the best resume, but it's almost best resume of teams that we know are good, right? We clearly, it's tough to leave Alabama out, not just because of their namesake, but it's like, are we sitting here and debating Alabama versus Oregon, right? Because we know that line
with
a healthy Tua is, it's massive. So that's the difficult thing. And as a committee member, you know that, right? Especially now with analytics being a little more prevalent, we've heard the commissioner speak about a lot of efficiency numbers sometimes in his dialogue and how he's assessed some of the teams and where they're placed. So, you know, that is in the back of their mind as well. It's difficult when you know a team's better and financially it's better to exclude Alabama, you know?
So one question I have for you, it's a hypothetical here, I'll lay it out, and I don't want to spend too much time on this because we obviously have games to get to. Ohio State loses to either Penn State, Michigan, or in the conference championship. They finish the season, let's say they win the conference championship, but they lose to Penn State or Michigan. They finish the season 12-1. Alabama finishes the season 11-1, and those two teams are vying for the fourth spot. How do you make the determination who gets in?
Yeah, I'm going with Ohio State, I think. That's where the schedule and the body of work would come into me, right? If you have an Ohio State versus an Alabama and you're saying, hey, who have you beaten? That's where I think the schedule would come into a little bit of play. How dominant have you been? And that becomes interesting. I also think, you know, let's see what Tua looks like. I would say that has to come into play as well. Does he get nicked up? Is he constantly going through the last couple of weeks at less than 100%? I think those are all real factors.
Because the other $100 million question that factors into it, and it'll be the last point on this, Ohio State theoretically loses one of those games without Chase Young. He serves his four-game suspension. He's back for the playoff. Do they get the same free pass that you know the committee's already trying to build in Alabama's loss against LSU, where Tua wasn't at 100%? I acknowledge that. He still threw for 400 yards, but Tua doesn't play defense, and Alabama gave up 46 points on their home field in a game they never led.
I think we were pretty spot on there. We thought LSU would score it at will. But, you know, when you're comparing a defensive end to a quarterback, that distinction gets a little more difficult. And I'm a huge fan of Chase Young. He'll probably be one of the first three picks. And it looks like potentially the Dolphins would be landing Chase Young at this point if they end the season with two wins. I think it's tough just because he plays a different position, and that's the reality of it. But I want to see what Tua looks like moving forward. Do we expect him out there this weekend?
You know what? It's not a game we're going to cover in great detail. If I'm setting odds on this, I make Tua about a $1.35 favorite to not be Alabama's starting quarterback this weekend against Mississippi State.
It would make some sense, I would think.
I mean, at this point, knowing what Tua has at stake in his future, knowing what Alabama theoretically has at stake the remainder of the season in that Iron Bowl, I wouldn't play him this week against Mississippi State. I sure as shit wouldn't play him against Western Carolina, and I would do everything I possibly could to have him ready to go for that Iron Bowl. So if you went out there and you made a statement against an Auburn team and to try and leave the voters or the committee with that lasting impression, that might change my tune in terms of Alabama at least having that signature win to close out the regular season.
I got to tell you, this hosting thing's a breeze.
Which
I'm
hosting
thing? I'm just lobbing them to you today.
Well, I mean, it's basically spin it up like a top and get me going on certain topics. And it's not, here's the thing. I just want consistency in all of this. I either want to know it's the best teams or it's the most deserving. Don't use the narrative to fit the biggest brands that are out there like they did last year for Notre Dame, saying that they were the most deserving, and this year saying Alabama's the best. If it was consistency all the way through, then hey, I'm perfectly fine with it. We're going to take a combination of the two. But the fact is, I just don't have enough trust in the committee and the way that they handle their business to believe they're doing things the right way.
Their business is making money.
Well, Dad, there's no doubt about it. But all right, enough on that particular topic. We actually have games that you can bet instead of speculating on some of this nonsense that's out there. And we may as well start in the Big Ten. And Payne, we might be making Bet the Board podcast history today by including one of these teams in our big game breakdown that I don't think we have in the short run that we've done a college football podcast.
Indiana?
You know it. The Indiana Hoosiers crack the top 25 for the first time in 25 years. Congratulations to Coach Allen and what he's done there to get this team to 7-2. They go into Happy Valley, catching 14.5. Total on the game, 55 at Fox Bet. Penn State, how do they bounce back from a little bit of adversity? But some other things to keep in mind with Indiana. First time they've won 7 games since 2007. First time they've won 4 straight conference games since 1993. And they finally shed that stigma of the longest drought of a team from a Power 5 conference not being included in the top 25. But the big question is, Payne, can they last and compete with the Nittany Lions with an extra week to prepare?
We're going to find out. And I think these are the games, you know, that require a little more projecting and opinion than most, right? Because I think there's two things that are really true here. Indiana hasn't won a game against a soul, right? Like, their seven wins are against teams with an average efficiency ranking of 97th overall, and the two losses come against the best two teams on the schedule, and I get it, right? As you alluded to, first time they've been ranked since 94, third time in school history, seven wins, so the optimism's high. Allen's done a good job, and we have been higher on Indiana than most. I've been talking to you about their offense now for like a couple weeks. You're like, where do you have them? So I'm kind of on board, but I'm also cognizant that it's been a pretty easy schedule. The other thing I think here that's really true is Penn State's defense, like we mentioned last week, probably not as good as the metrics indicate, right? Had faced one top 50 offense all season at home. Then you take a step up in class against Minnesota's offense and, you know, you allow Morgan to complete 90% of his passes. Penn State gives up 7.7 yards a play last week, two more than the national average. So to me, on paper, Indiana's offense is going to be the second toughest that Penn State's faced. Let's see if they respond. I know James Franklin's kind of, come out. All the players have said the right things about not letting Minnesota beat them twice. And we've seen the last few seasons under James Franklin, when Penn State does lose that first, it tends to be a second as well. When I look at Indiana's offense, though, it seems to me, and again, you watch these games, all of them, much more intently than I do, Indiana's offense seems a little one-dimensional in my mind, right? When you look at their offensive line, better as pass protectors than movers in the ground game, 107th in line yards, 122nd in stuff rate. So they're not great running the ball. You do have Penn State getting their defensive tackle back, Antonio Shelton, after the one-game suspension. You look at how Penn State is defensively. Better against the run as well. 27% of runs, great successful. So they've been fantastic in that area. So to me, it's on Peyton Ramsey's shoulder. It's on WAP out wide to kind of do damage against the PSU secondary.
Can you say WAP on the podcast?
Isn't that his name?
Yeah, no, it is.
That's his real nickname. I double checked that too, just because I know we have a bunch of pronunciation pros out there listening to us. That's his real name. I initially thought it was just a nickname, but
WAP Filer, baby, one of the best names in college football.
Yeah, he's fantastic too. And I think that's you know, the area we outlined last week and said, hey, we saw Michigan's offense, which was kind of in a funk, come alive in that second half against Penn State. All of a sudden, this trio for Minnesota probably will have some success here, and sure enough, they did. When you look at Indiana, they're predominantly operating out of 11 personnel. They have five pass catchers that have at least 20 receptions and two touchdowns each, so there is some depth there as well. It'll be interesting in games like this, right? When you have a good defense that kind of gets knocked around, can they mentally get over the hurdle quickly? You know, last week I was just stunned, man. Like, Morgan was fantastic, but you just look, 67% of his passes graded successful. The trio that I mentioned there, Bateman, Johnson, and Bell, caught 17 of their 19 targets. So there was just zero resistance in the back half. And so again, like, I've just been a little bit higher on Indiana's offense than most. You kind of look at some of their passing metrics, 18th in success rate, 31st in explosive passing. So we have kind of diagnosed some potential issues there. I think Indiana is going to have to move it through the air if they're going to cover this number. I think they might have some success moving the ball a little bit here.
I'd like this game a lot better to make a case for the underdog with 2 weeks to prepare, knowing they were more well-rested if they still had Michael Penix available. He gave them a nice changeup at the starting quarterback position, and a little bit of a different dynamic and dimension. But there's no doubt about it. You mentioned Penn State and some of their struggles in the secondary. And I feel like we talk about this until we're blue in the face as far as the Big Ten and how ill-prepared a lot of these defenses are to deal with athletes. Minnesota knew going into that game, Minnesota was going to boast arguably the most talented tandem, or we can call it a trio, I guess, of wide receivers that they'd played all season long. You mentioned the Michigan game where Penn State had no answers once that Michigan team started rolling downhill. It was ultimately a drop in the end zone that caught Michigan a chance at the full comeback. Indiana isn't quite of that same class, so I think Penn State should be a little bit more prepared for this particular matchup. But Payne, we're not being rocket scientists when a lot of the things you say, the market definitely agrees with. That's part of why we've seen this total open 50, 50 and a half, bet up to 54 and a half, 55, because not only do I think Indiana has some success, but Penn State's offense should find a breath of fresh air when you look at how the Hoosiers have struggled. I mean, this team gave up 28 points to Maryland, and you've watched the Terps over the last couple weeks. I didn't know that was possible.
And I think the big thing here that we can get out of the way, despite the loss last week, Penn State had no issues moving the ball, right? 7.1 per play. The problem was the three turnovers at the Minnesota 48, 25, and 24. And then you look, there was an additional three drives to the Minnesota 15, 5, and 3 that resulted in a grand total of 6 points. So when you lose a game by one score and all of those six things happen, it's more about what you didn't do than what Minnesota did. And I don't want to discredit the win, but there were certainly some opportunities there for Penn State's offense that they let slip away. And the one odd thing is, if you remember, one of the talking points last week was Penn State's advantage in the red zone over that Gophers defense. Penn State went into the game 7th in red zone scoring percentage, Minnesota defensively 70th. And, you know, it's clear sample size matters. So I think, like, the point here is that one game, the offensive performance where you have effectively six stops in great deep territory and you don't do much with it, we just chalk it up as a one-game sample size. So we didn't really make an adjustment. There wasn't a downward tick for PSU overall ratings-wise. And I think, to your point, even with Tom Allen, even with Indiana having 2 weeks to prepare, Penn State's going to move the ball here. And if you look, you know, the Hoosiers have faced Ohio State, but that's really the only top 50 offense they've gone against. The next best was Nebraska without Adrian Martinez. The eight offenses Indiana's faced not named Ohio State, average offensive efficiency ranking, 85th, right? You know, against the five offenses that Indiana has faced inside the top 100 in efficiency, which is only 5 of 9 teams, the Hoosiers have given up 35 points per game on average. So, you know, to me, I think they're going to give up some points here as well. Even your boy, right? The favorite offense of Todd Furman this season, run by the man, the myth, the legend.
They hung 40. They hung 40 on him. I didn't think that was possible.
34 offensive points, nearly 8.5 yards per pass attempt. So I think Penn State offensively doesn't skip a beat, and they're probably a little better in the money zones this week than last.
Let me tell you, let's peel back the curtain a little bit about what unfolded last weekend in college football. There was one game we both watched intently. We knew who was on the game. We knew how sharp the position was, as the number had been bet from under 2 touchdowns out to about 15 and a half. And one of the first scores I saw with our beloved Spartans was 28-3, Payne. I know you and I were both kicking ourselves going, Michigan State's finally going to get it done. They're actually going to get to the window and cover. The little bit of me actually found a second wind and life watching them crumble like the cheap tent and the makeshift outfit they were against the Fighting Illini in the fourth quarter.
Well, it's a good thing. And speaking about, you know, jumping through hoops with some of the best bets that we can give out, we liked Michigan State. And I know a couple of groups that played it, but for the mental stability of our listeners, chose not to give it out.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And the Spartans, of course, have a big game this weekend against Michigan, one that just missed the cut in terms of being one of our five-game breakdowns. Last thing on the Indiana-Penn State game that I think is worth noting, you look at the Hoosiers, they have not exactly thrived when odds makers install them as an underdog. 1-14 straight up the last 15 times we've seen that happen, and not exactly a robust number against the spread where they're 5-10. Indiana 0-10 all-time in Happy Valley. They've now lost 37 consecutive games to top 10 teams dating back to 1987. We'll see if they can get off the schneid this weekend. From that game, Payne, I feel it's a logical segue to the opponent that Penn State faced last week, that being the Minnesota Golden Gophers. And Minnesota puts their undefeated...
You're my hero.
Why? You have something else you want to add on that game? Or
the logical segue, yeah. It's the next one in the rotation order.
I'm trying to make it sound like we're reinventing the wheel around here, all right? Don't rain on my parade or piss on me and tell me it's raining outside. Or what's that phrase go?
Yeah, he nailed it.
All right. Minnesota, 3-point underdogs on the road at Kinnick Stadium against the Iowa Hawkeyes. Total in the game, 44 at Fox Bet. And when I look at this particular game, Payne, the Minnesota Golden Gophers, for maybe the first time all season, are officially playing a football game with a target squarely on their back. This will be their first true road game, in my opinion. Going to Rutgers doesn't count. And arguably the best team that they've played on the road since Fresno State. I mean, Minnesota hasn't won at Kinnick Stadium since 1999. I think you were probably, you know, trying to compete for All-State honors playing soccer back then, or junior high, however old you are. When I look at this game, offensively,
I'm young and fresh.
Yeah, that's debatable. You keep working with me long enough, or we have football seasons like this, you're going to age a lot more prematurely than you'd ever like it to happen.
Question, we're going left field here. Hate to interrupt you. Is there going to be a rekindling of souls here with Rutgers and Shiano? I'm hearing some things
there. I think it's
there.
A done deal. And one can only hope it works out as well as things have worked out for UConn football, bringing back, I can't even remember his name right now. Coach Edsel, sorry. So Lord only knows. I guess you try and go back. You nostalgize the past. I mean, as a DePaul Blue Demons fan, Dave Leto hasn't exactly worked out, but maybe Rutgers will find a little jump start to a program that's been a doormat, to say the least, over the last couple of years.
Quentin Richardson doesn't have any eligibility left is the problem there.
No, nor does Sammy Mejia or Wilson Chandler, but it'd be great if we could get that trio out there at the same time.
There you go. All right, let's kind of focus in here. I don't even know what we're talking about.
All right, we're talking about Iowa and Minnesota, and I think the matchup worth watching here is the Minnesota offense, which was on full display last weekend against Penn State, matched up against an Iowa defense, a Hawkeye stop unit that has not allowed more than 24 points in a single game this season.
Two really drastic performances, I think, with the two units. You know, like Tanner Morgan, I don't know where that came from. I know he's been fantastic. I was kind of banging the table that he would be the starter this season, and I think from what I was hearing, it was only because of injury he was ended up being named the starter. So when you look at last week's performances, Minnesota couldn't be stopped. Iowa's defense was gouged on the ground, and you know, I had a chance actually to rewatch. They replayed it on the Big Ten Network, so I said, hey, let me just pop this on in the background here. Iowa just could not even stop the run when they put 7 and 8 guys in the box. It just didn't matter. Wisconsin had 58% of their runs grade successful. So they're going to have to, Iowa, that is, figure out how to shore up that front seven. Now, it's impossible for Morgan to replicate, right, 90% completions and 17 yards an attempt. And, you know, he was actually perfect on throws over the middle between the hashes. I think the fear would be the Hawkeye secondary, obviously getting exposed by Bateman, Johnson, and Bell. You look at Bateman last week, the explosiveness was just through the roof. You know, average 29 a catch. 6 of his 7 receptions went for first downs, the other a touchdown. The difference here is, and it's always tough to make this claim because, again, as you alluded to at the top, it's very rare that Big Ten defenses see speed on offense. But Iowa does do a good job limiting big plays, right? Number 1 in explosive play defense overall. Top 10 against both the run and pass in terms of explosiveness. Kirk Ferentz came out this week at his presser. He said the secondary could be the healthiest it's been all season coming into this game, which would be a pleasant, you know, welcoming back, I think. For me, it's really important Iowa wins on first down defensively, right? We know they play this bend but don't break style. And if an offense is willing to take the short stuff and methodically move it, they can have success. And we know Minnesota's an RPO offense, right, with a mobile quarterback. So they might be able to do that. But you look where the Gophers are a little lackluster, let's call it, on offense. It's first down. 64th in the country in success rate on first down. And that's obviously the down that sets you up. So if Iowa can win that down defensively and force Tanner Morgan and company to kind of into that second and third and long where it's a known passing situation, you know, you're going to have a shot. Listening to like a handful of the Iowa defenders, they're not happy with last week's performance. They realize they need to step up this week. We know Kinnick Stadium obviously has a huge advantage, certainly a hostile environment. You mentioned what Minnesota's done in their road games, you know, at Fresno, at Purdue, at Rutgers. This is a different animal. You do have to worry about the Gophers' speed. past that, maybe. You worry about some fatigue late. Iowa's on the field for 40 minutes last week, basically getting leaned on by like physical Badgers O-linemen. This just needs to be a step-up game, right? Like, wildly disappointing to me when I was looking at this game. I went back to look at some preseason numbers and projections from us, did some reading of some articles during the preseason, and then kind of compared things to what's going on now. This was supposed to be like a really good Iowa defensive line. It's supposed to be the strength. Everything that you read, and you just look right now, 79th in line yards, 78th in stuff rate, 66th in sack rate. It's just not good enough right now, Todd.
No, I mean, Iowa clearly was one of the teams that a lot of people had pegged as a favorite to come out of the Big Ten West. I think we were a little bit more skeptical, and I believe we actually talked about Minnesota being one of those sleeping programs if they could figure out the quarterback situation. And you mentioned Tanner Morgan, who put together a pretty impressive performance, to say the least, last week against Penn State. He was only the second FBS quarterback in the last 20 years to have multiple games in a single season where he completed 90% of his passes. But a lot of the things you mentioned there, this just feels like Iowa in general. And when there are games that nobody expects them to win, there's at least one or two a year at Kinnick where they rise up and they put together their best effort. I saw a lot of the same comments you did from Coach Ferentz talking about the secondary and big play prevention. And we mention it all the time, and you've got me looking at it a lot more than I ever did in the past. So much of what Minnesota did last week against Penn State wasn't necessarily methodical. It was being able to hit the home run. And it's even that much more important when you go out on the road, because if they're going to try and string together a 10 to 12 play drive against Iowa, I just don't see Minnesota being built that way to do that time and time again against the Hawkeyes in their own building, in a spot that's really been a house of horrors for Gophers football.
Yeah. They have dominated this series for sure. Now, obviously, Minnesota is drastically different this year with PJ Fleck. But the line insinuates here that Iowa is certainly the side.
On the other side of the ball real quick, and I don't think this matchup is nearly as fascinating, and I know we have a lot of Iowa fans that'll be out there listening going, oh, you guys are going to bash Nate Stanley again. Stanley was actually good against Wisconsin. That two-point.
It's not Nate Stanley. I was a big Nate Stanley fan, if you remember going back to last year. I think we hyped the shit out of him going into that Penn State game last year, and he was going to kind of be the difference maker, I believe. And I still like him. I just hate the guy operating the offense, or I should say the guy pulling the strings, so to speak, from above.
You mean you didn't like the quarterback draw on the two-point conversion with a chance to tie against Wisconsin last weekend? You didn't think that was the most inventive play call that they could have run in that particular spot with a quarterback that doesn't exactly have the same athleticism as Lamar Jackson?
No, but he's bigger, and you'd hope he'd move, you know, the pile forward a little bit. I think it's inventive in Brian Ferentz's mind. And the funny part was, if you listen to some of the Wisconsin guys, they're like, that threw us completely off guard. And I think that's the other issue, right? Like, their offensive line was supposed to be a strength again, and it's not, but I don't know. I hate talking about Iowa's offense, honestly. And so
we can wrap it up in about 35 seconds if you have a nugget that you want to share, and I'm happy to move on to another game, which the trajectory of that particular contest has changed pretty rapidly over the last 12 minutes.
Listen, like, this is probably more venting than breaking down the matchup, but like, Ryan Ferentz needs to be better. The imagination is really poor. The play calling's poor. He doesn't seem to have like a feel for these games. And as a play caller, you know, you have to have a feel and intuition, and I think probably there's some coaches listening and they're like shaking their heads. Yeah, there is like a feel process to this. It's extremely difficult to say this, obviously, about a guy that's going to forget more football than I'll ever know. But if Ferentz spent any time looking at any of the metrics, you would think some of these things are crystal clear, right? Like Stanley throwing more on early downs, being less predictable on second down situations. And you look last week, Iowa has 40 passing yards the first 43 minutes of the game. And then all of a sudden, right, you're down 21-6 heading to the fourth, and you're forced to pass. And guess what? Against a very good defense in Wisconsin who knows you have to pass now, I was still able to pass efficiently enough to need that two-point conversion to tie the game, right? So, like, what would have happened if Ferentz decided to pass when Wisconsin, or any opponent for that matter, didn't know you actually had to? And so I think that's the big thing here, right? And you look at the metrics again. Nate Stanley last week on standard downs where both the run and the pass are in play, he completes 67% of his passes for 9.4 an attempt. On known passing downs, Stanley completes 50% for 2.2 yards an attempt. So, you know, you look at the last five games overall, Iowa's averaging 2.5 yards. Actually less, 2.48 yards per rush in the last five games, and yet they're running on more than 50% of the time. So you would just hope, right, that Iowa throws it a little more often this week. When they do run it, they probably have a little bit of an edge against Minnesota, right? They're not overly large up front. They're 77th in line yards defensively, 114th in stuff rate. So if you can be balanced, if you can occasionally throw on early downs, then when you do eventually run, you won't be doing it against loaded boxes, right? When you look at the first down success rate on this side of the matchup, Iowa has an advantage there. The Gophers defense just inside the top 70 in first down success rate allowed. So, you know, if the right game plan's installed, if Stanley plays well, I think Iowa should actually be able to move the ball here, you know? And I think the other key is when Iowa does get into the money zone and the red zone, they have to start finishing drives. Iowa's 99th in scoring opportunity on drives inside the opponent 40. And, you know, there's a reason Keith Duncan is, you know, already set Iowa's single season record for field goals with four damn games to go. They have as many field goals as touchdowns, 22 apiece. So to me, pass on early downs to set up the run. You should have success running it probably either way if your offensive line wakes the hell up. And there's supposed to be like potentially three guys drafted from that O-line. So it needs to be better across the board. Both these offensive and defensive lines need to step up. Ferentz needs to kind of be a little more imaginative, get Nate Stanley throwing in early downs. If that's the case, I think Iowa's got a shot here for sure.
Those 22 touchdowns rank Iowa 112th in the country as far as scoring. And you mentioned the field goal issues. Two players to keep an eye on for Iowa that need to get more touches, especially in space. Tyler Goodson only carried the ball five times, arguably Iowa's most explosive running back. And knowing that Brandon Smith will be down again, expect Tyrone Tracy to be the guy that they have to isolate in space and take advantage of a good Minnesota secondary. But you mentioned they're a little smaller up front, so run the football, set up play action, and create some big opportunities down the field. From Big Ten country, we'll stick it out in the Midwest, a game that's been on the move all morning, Payne. The Notre Dame Fighting Irish playing host to the Naval Academy Midshipmen. This number now down to 7 at Fox Bet. Total on the game sits at 54. I hear a little snicker there.
Six and a half at one point.
You like the move? You like the move on a Wednesday morning? I mean, I don't even know if I want to spend time on this game because it's going to get under my skin.
Happy with the move. Happy with the move.
Third time in the last 9 meetings, Navy will find themselves catching single digits against the Fighting Irish. The other two times it's happened, Navy has actually won both of those games outright. This is and also the first time these two teams will meet where both are ranked since 1978. Let's see what Navy's got. They have an extra week to prepare. The Midshipmen's offense has been clicking on all cylinders, 385-plus rushing yards in each of their last 4 games. But, Payne, I think the bigger story with Navy and the reason that they've seen such a reversal of fortune this year is a defense and one that's become one of the most disruptive in the entire country.
Yeah, we actually don't mind their defense, right? And in a game like this, you know, going up against Navy's defense comes down to Ian Book, basically, right? Like being more efficient, not turning it over, continuing to use his legs, right? I think every single possession is important when you play Navy because there's probably not a ton of them. And, you know, I was kind of just looking at this matchup. The advantage Notre Dame's offense will have here is obviously with some speed and some size on the perimeter, they're going to have to hit some big explosive plays in the pass game. That's where Navy's defense has had their struggle. They're barely inside the top 100 in defending explosive passes. Notre Dame's offense, top 20 in big passes. Now, speaking strictly metrically, and this might make some people laugh or cry if you're a Notre Dame fan, this will be the fourth toughest offense Navy's faced this season going against the Irish, okay? We actually have, in terms of offensive efficiency, across the board total, right? Memphis, Tulane, and Air Force are all better in terms of total efficiency. They're all top 30. But when you look at those games specifically, Navy's defense in those 3 games have allowed an average of 30 points. Notre Dame, we have 35th. They have some issues along the O-line still a little bit. I know there's two new guys kind of getting implemented in there because of some injuries. There is a massive talent gap here, obviously. Size gap, athleticism gap. But again, just like metrically speaking, Todd, Navy's only allowed 34% of runs to grade successful. Top 20 against the run and pass. When you look at Navy's defense even further, 10th in line yards, 12th in sack rate, 14th in havoc rate. Like, I don't know what I'm seeing here. Clearly, Navy's defense isn't as good as these metrics indicate. I get the three best offenses Navy's faced, you know, have given up some, they've given up some points. I see that, you know, when I look at the season-long metrics, the average efficiency rank of the opponents is 81st. But you would just think, you know, 2 weeks to prepare for a rival, a familiar opponent. Which defense do we see, right? I actually watched the Tulane game. In the first 23 minutes, Navy's shutting them out. And then all of a sudden, things go into like a tailspin, the final 37. And Tulane hangs, I think, 35, the final, you know, 37 minutes or so. I just don't know what I'm missing here in regards to Navy's defense. And again, you watch all these things. What are they?
I mean, I think they're average. I think they feast on a lot of lightweights and are able to take full advantage. But it's a boomer bust defense. I mean, it's part of the reason that they have so many tackles for loss over the last couple of games. They've been effective intercepting passes. And I think that's kind of the way you have to play if you're Ken Niumatalolo and you're in these defensive meetings and you're trying to figure out how you're going to scheme for opponents, is who you mentioned are much better athletically, knowing that Navy has one defensive starter that weighs over 260 pounds, three that weigh over 240. So if you can create a short field, you can be disruptive. I think a turnover with the way Navy plays offense is that much more debilitating. And we saw it a couple of years ago where Navy and Notre Dame played one of the slowest games or fewest possessions that you're going to see in college football, where the Irish possessed the ball for six times. And right now, Navy's offense has been able to do so much that they're willing to take that risk. Because honestly, if you're Navy, and we talk about how explosive plays change the momentum, it may not be the worst thing in the world. If you put together an eight-minute march and you're able to kick a field goal or score a touchdown, the opponent gets the ball back, you try and go for a big play, hey, it turns into a 75-yard touchdown. All of a sudden, your offense is back out in the field, and you put together another eight-minute march, that's absolutely exhausting, and it puts the opposing defense in such a hole that you almost wish that you were able to take more time off the clock to force Navy's defense to be out there for more snaps.
Without a question, and I think, you know, this game in general is very basic, right? Like, if Notre Dame can stop the run, it's difficult for Navy to win here. And, you know, you always hate kind of going into battle with one option, but Navy's got a great freaking option. So, you know, if Navy were to win this game, and I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility here, the last two meetings have been decided by eight total points. And I think Navy's got a lot to play for here. You know, just kind of reading some things, a group of five bid to the Cotton Bowl is not out of the question. And I think if Navy wins here, they probably position themselves pretty nicely. I think there's three things, right? Obviously, Navy needs to be able to run. I think they're going to need to be able to hit like an explosive pass or two or three. And can Navy kind of continue dominating once it gets in the green and red zone? So those are the three things, right? And you look right now, despite the entire world knowing they want to run, 50% of their runs are still graded successful, 16th in the country. We've seen Notre Dame's defensive line kind of get beat up in the trenches this season against the run. They lost a lot of interior talent on the defensive line and with the linebacker unit. Now you're down probably one of your best edge defenders in Okara. When you look at the point of attack, Navy's O-line 19th in line yards. Notre Dame's defense 52nd. It's why Notre Dame's defense right now 45th in the country in rushing success rate defense. In terms of explosive passing, And Navy rarely throws it, right? So this metric's absolutely distorted, but they're number one in explosive pass percentage. So it's that element of surprise. It works a little bit, right? So when Ken dials up the pass, I think it's important that Perry connects on two, three, or four of these big throws in this game, make Notre Dame's corners, you know, have it in the back of their mind that they can't always cheat run and help in the ground game, you know? The last thing that I see here, if the upset's going to happen or the outright win's going to happen, Navy needs to continue to be dominant scoring touchdowns. If you look, and I know, right, it's like it's 2019, everyone loves the chuck and duck offense, But still right now, the best offenses are the ones that are able to run inside the 40 and the 20, right? Getting touchdowns instead of settling for field goals. Navy's number one in touchdown percentage when they reach the 40 and the 20. That's got to continue here.
And you mentioned how effective they've been with the big play. I think Malcolm Perry is a home run waiting to happen. And he has 29 completions off play action this season. Those completions average about 25 yards a pop. So if you're the Naval Academy, you know how your bread is buttered. You know how you're going to be able to try and run the football. You need to be able to hit one of those plays over the top, as you mentioned. And when you look at the Irish, I think this is a team that I have a lot more questions than I do answers. I know they played a quarterback-oriented run attack last weekend in Duke, but what Navy is going to do is a heck of a lot different than what the Irish will encounter. Not only is Navy effective, as you mentioned, scoring inside the 40 and inside the 20, they're one of the best in the country in extending drives, both on third and fourth down, where I think they're now 15 of 18 on fourth down at about an 83% success rate. So fascinating matchup from South Bend. Very curious to see how this unfolds and if Navy can keep what's been a resurgent season by their standards on the tracks with a nice upset of Notre Dame. From South Bend, we head to the SEC, Payne, where Georgia takes on a rested Auburn side. Georgia now firmly entrenched in the college football playoff, very much in control of their own destiny at the four spot. Find themselves 2.5-point road favorites in this historic rivalry. Total on this game has been bet down substantially from an open of 44.5, 45, now sitting at 40 at FoxBet. And when we look at Kirby Smart, yes, he's 5-2 against Gus Malzahn-led offensive attacks, but those victories have rarely been due to a stellar defensive performance. Kirby Smart's defenses have allowed 34 or more in four of those seven contests. Last time these two teams played here at Jordan-Hare, Auburn won this game in an absolute runaway. We know all the pressure in the world is on Georgia. What does Auburn have to do from an offensive standpoint to really put this Bulldogs defense to the test?
Listen, you know, I think for 2 years now, there's been a lot of noise in what Georgia does defensively. And, you know, stats can be skewed in a number of ways. But I think what we do is always drastically different. And, you know, last year we kept saying this Georgia defense has issues. It's not remotely close to what people think it is. And then, boom, in the offseason, Kirby Smart nicely removes his defensive coordinator, right? And, you know, when you read local articles, right, when they pertain to Georgia, just this week, I was reading one, you know, like last night, and you're going to read stuff like, you know, the Bulldogs, they've only allowed 2.8 yards a carry and haven't allowed a rushing touchdown all season. And they're, you know, fourth in fewest rushing yards allowed. Look at the schedule, right?
Terrible, average terrible.
Yeah. I mean, average efficiency ranking of the offense faced for Georgia, 73rd. They've played one top 30 offense. If you look only at FBS opponents and you remove Murray State, in the eight other games, Georgia's defense has faced offenses that have an average rank of 70th in rushing success rate. So, you know, I don't think Auburn gets completely shut out, right, from running the ball. Georgia's D-line is still outside the top 50 in line yards, stuff rate, and havoc rate. We've talked about Auburn's offensive line, wildly improved, right? And now it would appear you're going to have two really capable backs with Booby Whitlow returning. He was cleared before the LSU game, dressed out for the last 2 weeks. Then he's had the bye. They wanted him 100%, so I think he's going to be a go in this game. And then in his absence, you have a freshman, DJ Williams, who's had one of the best starts for a freshman in you know, history of the Auburn program over the last two decades. So, you know, for me, I think the question becomes, can Bo Nix do enough as a passer, right? We've seen Gus Malzahn, as you alluded to, have some success against Kirby Smart's defense. Gus Malzahn does a very good job with his short passing game, really ripping up some defenses that like to play soft in the back. And, you know, Kirby Smart has had this bend but don't break style the last two seasons. So hopefully Malzahn dials up some short, quick passes. You get Bo Nix confident, and I think that Auburn's going to be able to do enough here to move the ball a little bit.
I mean, Auburn has had some success. Now, I know they haven't played as defenses as stout as what they're going to encounter on Saturday at home, but Bo Nix has looked like a different quarterback playing at home, and he's shown the kind of tendencies you'd expect from a freshman, much more confidence, the body language, and even came out and said that much this week, Payne, in doing some reading when he talked about how, you know, it's easier to obviously play at home and communicate because it's not as loud out there on the field. So he felt like the atmosphere really helps as far as adrenaline and things like that go. He said, flat out, I'd much rather be playing this game at home. We've seen him kind of grow up. He wasn't great against Florida by any stretch of the imagination. Showed a little bit of improvement against LSU. You'd have to think that a young quarterback can come of age in this particular spot. But the other matchup's worth watching. Auburn's no slouch defensively themselves. And when you look at this Georgia offense, we've seen them struggle in fits and spurts. Last weekend against Missouri, it is what it is. Lawrence Cager, though, one of the more reliable vertical threats dealing with a shoulder injury. He could be out, which places more emphasis on George Pickens. DeAndre Swift has had some success running against Auburn, but you'd have to think that Auburn's defensive line will be the biggest challenge by far that Georgia's offensive line has faced. And it's a unit that's received a ton of praise that I'm not necessarily as bullish on as some people out there.
You know, last time we saw Auburn's defense on the big stage, it was against LSU, right? And Kevin Steele is a very good defensive coordinator. You know, he threw something at the window there, hoping it would stick. And he went to this like 3-1-7 formation at LSU to stop the pass game. He hoped, right, that his two NFL guys along the defensive line could stop the LSU run game. Scoreboard-wise, cover-wise, that worked pretty well, but metrically not so much, right? Gave up over 500 yards of offense. I think the point is, like, we're not going to see that formation here. The entire goal for Auburn's defense is to choke out the ground game of Georgia, force the Bulldogs receivers to consistently win one-on-one, force Fromm to beat you over the top with explosives rather than, like, Swift just gashing you on the ground. And it's week 12, right? So after talking about these teams over and over again, it sounds repetitive. But as teams in week 12, you kind of are who you are at this point for the most part. So, like, when Auburn and Kevin Steele, like, watch last year's film. Swift goes for 186 yards on 17 carries. Holyfield, 93 on 15 carries. And then you see how the Georgia offense is constructed this year and how it's operating. You have 2 weeks to come up with a game plan. Like, bottom line, it's stop the run or lose. And so, you know, again, even after LSU gashes Auburn on the ground in this 3-1-7 formation, the Tigers are still seventh in rushing success rate defense. Only 33% of runs have graded successful. You remove sack yardage. Auburn's 23rd in yards per rush allowed. They're top 25 in both line yards and stuff rate as well. So, you know, this is going to be a fun trench game to watch. You got Brown, you got Davidson, you got Cat going up against probably the most complete offensive line in college football, right? You know, you look at Georgia's O-line, it's top 10 in line yard sack rate allowed, stuff rate allowed. I think, and it's weird metrically, right? Like, we know where Georgia's offense has had some struggles. I like Fromm more than anyone. And then you look at the metrics, it's like sixth in passing success rate. 53% of passes have graded successful. It's like, what's wrong with Georgia's offense? They're just not very explosive over the top. They're just not. 59th in explosive passing. So if you can shut down the ground game and you just force Fromm to become this like dink and dunk passer, the offense is pretty limited in what it can do. But the entire key to this game is just removing Swift from it. If Auburn can do that, they're going to have a real chance here. And I think, not to go too far backwards, but I am intrigued offensively. With 2 weeks to prepare to see what Gus Malzahn has up his sleeve, I would think there's probably a long script early on, and I would think there's probably a couple trick plays early on as well.
You mentioned the extra week to prepare, and we know this juncture of the season, it always benefits teams that can come in well-rested, especially before a rivalry game. How big an emphasis do you place on that? Do you think it's already built into the number? We talk all the time about sophistication of the market and how situations are more and more accounted for in 2019 than they were, you know, when both of us started gambling 10 plus years ago. Do you think that's factored into this number and that's why we're seeing the point spread where it is? Or do you feel that the market is pretty efficient based on just a core power number here?
Oh, you think this number's low?
Interesting. I look at this game. No, I don't actually think it's low. I'm higher on Auburn, I think, than most people. I think you and I are both higher on Auburn.
Yeah. Yeah. They've never left our top 10 this season, honestly. Even after the losses, I believe I'm looking right now. We have them. This is really bad. We have them as the eighth best team in the country right now, power ratings wise. So we've been high on Auburn, and it's a tricky team because we always thought we knew the talent of Bo Nix, right? As the maturation process continued, he'd continue to tick up each and every week. And you alluded to it, right? He's becoming more comfortable. All of his tough games against tough defenses have been in either neutral sites or on the road. Now he gets it at home. He's got 2 weeks to prepare. He's got Gus Malzahn, game planning and scheming. There was like this talk, I think, before the A&M game that like Malzahn hadn't shown like only 25% of his offense to that point. Now, we kind of made a joke of it and said, I think this is probably pretty egregious and a lie. But with 2 weeks to prepare, I would think that you're going to see a scripting of probably the first 25 to 30 plays here. And I think you're going to see some new wrinkles. I think you're going to see an occasional trick play this game. So I think that's where that added extra week comes into play here, Todd.
For any team not firmly entrenched in the college football playoff discussion, Payne, Auburn's going to have a massive say in which four teams are vying for that crystal ball in early January.
What if they went out?
You know what? I don't know if they're going to have enough to get in. I think they'd need a lot of other chaos around them just because you'd have so many one-loss teams. But it'd be one hell of a resume, a close loss against LSU by 3 points, which would be closer than Bama losing at home. Yep. You'd have that win over potentially a 12-1 Oregon team. You would then have a win against Alabama, and you would have a win against Georgia. It's a very interesting discussion for a team that I think, if they were able to pull off that feat, would be power rated for us inside the top five.
I think so as well. I would love to see that unfold. Just create chaos.
That's all we live for. We live for chaos in the college football landscape to keep people up at night. And throw a little wrench into some of the best laid plans for the blue blood programs that are out there. Final big game of the weekend. It'll be where College Game Day is going, on the banks of the Brazos River in lovely Waco, Texas, where Oklahoma is a massive 10-point favorite. Total in the game, 67.5 right now at FoxBet, to take on a still undefeated Baylor Bears team. A Baylor Bears side that feels they're being completely disrespected by the polls, as they'll take an 11-game win streak into Saturday's game. And they're the lowest ranked of the five remaining undefeated FBS teams, behind LSU, Ohio State, Clemson, and the Golden Gophers. Payne, I know the matchup that everyone's going to want to watch here is Oklahoma's high-powered offense against Baylor's defense, but let's start on the other side of the ball, where I think Charlie Brewer is going to have an opportunity to exploit an Oklahoma defense that showed a lot of vulnerability over the last 2 weeks in surrendering 40-plus points against Iowa State and Kansas State.
That's the perfect spot to start, because this game is going to be on Charlie Brewer's shoulders. When you look at how you want to attack Oklahoma, right, it's one, obviously, with physicality in the trenches and playing a north-south style, punching them in the mouth. But when you just look metrically, the best advantage that Baylor has here is moving the ball through the air. And Charlie Brewer's been fantastic. We've seen his growth and maturation over the last few seasons. Right now, Baylor, 22nd in the country in passing success rate. Over 47% of their passes are grading successful. That's kind of the vulnerability and the weakness of Oklahoma's defense, right? They come in 43rd in that category. I think it's very important that you hit some big plays. We know with Alex Grinch's style, right, it's a lot of swarming to the ball. It's trying to create negative plays. It's trying to create turnovers. They haven't really been turning anyone over recently, but they have been giving up big explosive plays. And Baylor's offense can hit that. Fourth in the country in explosive play offense. Oklahoma's defense, 110th. So I think that's where the edge lies here. Get Charlie Brewer going early. Get him comfortable. Get him passing the ball efficiently. Try to strike deep. And I think you'll have some success here moving the ball. Now, you watched the game last week. I kind of flipped it off and went to go be a normal human after State got down for 21 the third time in the game. And then all of a sudden, I get like a text from you. It's like, holy cow, 2-point conversion here to title. What happened to the Oklahoma defense? Did they just get complacent, or what did you see unfold there?
Well, it was almost as though the offense kind of took its foot off the gas a little bit. We know, right, Iowa State's about as pesky a team as you're going to find in the country. And what happened is they started committing to running the football with Breece Hall. I mean, the opening drive of the second half, they went out there, they imposed their will physically. And you could see momentum starting to shift at that point. But the other thing was, lost in Oklahoma racing out to that big lead in the first half was some poor decision-making from Jalen Hurts that I don't think I'd seen most of the season. There were a couple of balls he threw directly to Iowa State defenders, and I counted three that I would define as interceptable passes, two that probably should have been pick sixes. So Oklahoma was flirting with disaster there. It ultimately caught up to Jalen Hurts late in the game where he has that ill-advised pass on the sidelines. I know Iowa State was aggressive. They went for two late in the game, and Oklahoma won't get credit for the turnover on a stat sheet, but they did intercept Brock Purdy in the end zone. It was the game plan that I expected to see from Iowa State offensively for a full four quarters. They just weren't able to execute it early on. And from a defensive standpoint, they started to find things to disrupt some of the flow. The other thing about it too, Oklahoma will be down one of their top running backs in Trey Sermon, but it was just a weird football game on so many levels where you never felt like Oklahoma was in jeopardy. And you look up at the scoreboard in the fourth quarter and you go, holy shit, Iowa State's really going to have a chance to go into Norman and win here for the second time in 3 years.
Yeah, that's kind of what it seemed like. And so, you know, Charlie Brewer and company are going to obviously have to keep pace a little bit here. I would like them to throw to set up the run, but when they do decide to run, they could have some success there as well, because we've seen Oklahoma, they've been a little better stopping the run down to down, but within that aggressiveness, again, they give up large chunks. So whether it's Lovett or Hasty or even Charlie Brewer on a keeper, there's potential for some long runs here. I was shocked to see this, but Oklahoma's defense, 124th in the country, an explosive run defense. So I think Baylor's going to have an opportunity here to potentially hit a few big plays that might be able to keep them in the game.
Yeah, it was interesting, Matt. Some of Matt Rule's comments talking about right now the way this Baylor offensive line is constructed, that they're in a spot where they have to wait for the opposing pass rushers to tire before they can take some shots downfield. So if you read between the tea leaves, it sounds like you're going to operate in a 5-10 yard window, try and run the football early, and then take those shots to guys like Denzel Mims. Baylor, let's not kid ourselves, extremely fortunate to get through TCU last week. A young kid steps up, sauces a 51-yard field goal, and then you see Baylor's offense make some big plays in overtime. But every now and again, you need one of those wake-up calls, and God, Baylor's had a ton of them so far this season. But every game has been competitive that they've played as far as one-score game. So there is that level of familiarity. If this game is tight, I think the balance shifts to Baylor. And when you're a 10-point underdog, no one's telling you you have to go out there and build a 21-point lead. We'll get to the other side of the ball in a second. But Payne, I don't ever like to make comparisons because it's not, well, I shouldn't say that. I don't ever like to make leap of faith comparisons because it's not always apples to apples. But when I look at this matchup here, and I think I shot you a text, this way it's going for Baylor reminds me a lot of what, you know, Coach, God, I mean, this is how shot my brain is. Stanford's head coach. How things go with David Shaw, and when he realized, hey, I don't have the athletes to compete with Oregon in space, I'm going to hit you in the mouth, I'm going to play more physically defensively, and that's how I'm going to try and go out there and win the games. It seems like that's the kind of rivalry we have brewing here with Matt Rule against Lincoln Riley, David Shaw against Oregon's head coaches back in the day where Stanford tried to shift the balance of power in the Pac-12.
Yeah, and to your point, Baylor's offensive line hasn't been great. It's kind of the last thing Matt Rule needs to improve. As his recruiting notches up another rung, but they have had issues protecting Charlie Brewer. But I think when you look at the other side of the ball, that's going to play a huge role here as well. I have been higher on Baylor's defense than I think most have been. But again, you know, I'm not sure how good they are metrically, right? Like last week, there were some underlying things going on with TCU's offense and their quarterback having an injured hand. So, you know, you don't want to take too much from that. But when you just look across the board, Baylor's defense, 14th in line yards, 16th in stuff rate, 29th in yards per carry allowed when you exclude sacks, 21st in rushing success rate. Now, you know, you don't have Clay Johnston, who was the heart of your defense. So that's obviously been an impact in recent weeks where there has been a little dip in production defensively. But you just wonder what Oklahoma is kind of doing offensively. And it's tough to say because they're going out there and you have Lincoln Riley and you have Jalen Hurts and you have all these weapons and they're scoring a ton of points. But like they seem to be like allergic to handing the ball off, right? Like 2 weeks ago, we talked about this, like Kennedy Brooks and Trey Sermon had 6 combined carries. And then last week in a game where Oklahoma leads Iowa State by 21 points 3 different times, Brooks and Sermon's have 16 total carries. It's just wild, right? Where you want to attack Baylor's defense is through the air. 65th in passing success rate defense. So, you know, Matt Rule has always preferred you to efficiently move the ball down the field rather than hit them with the explosive. So Baylor does a great job there, you know, preventing big plays, third best in that regard. fifth in explosive pass defense. And I think when you look at a guy like CeeDee Lamb, the big playability, you have to be sure tacklers. That dude's averaging 11.8 yards per reception after the catch. So if Baylor can make Hurts methodically move the ball down the field, be sure tacklers, they have a chance here. Baylor's got to find a way to get pressure too, right? On the season, they're top 25 in both sack rate and havoc rate. Create some negative plays. Win on first down. When Jalen Hurts does use his legs like he did 22 times last week, I'm going to say this as nicely as possible, you got to pop him, right? We've seen kind of the blueprint, Todd, to Jalen Hurts, right? You make him pay when he runs it. And if you can get him in third and long as a known passer, that's pretty much your only chance when you're going against Hurts with Lincoln Riley pulling the strings.
Yeah, it puts him behind the eight ball. And when you look at the way Baylor has performed, a lot of the times they've utilized just a three-man rush, and they seem to be optimistic they'll be able to get pressure, which affords you umbrella coverage or to do a number of different things with your back seven, back eight, to complicate throwing lanes and make it much more convoluted for Jalen Hurts to run the offense. One matchup, and you mentioned CeeDee Lamb. I think it's worth noting that Jamison Houston, one of Baylor's outstanding corners, has done a great job limiting some of the best receivers in the country. You mentioned TCU and the struggles that Max Duggan had with the hand. So I put a little bit of an asterisk by Jalen Reagor's one catch for 8 yards last week. But even against Oklahoma State's Tylan Wallace before Wallace was lost for the season, Houston held him to 6 catches for 69 yards. I think if you can hold CeeDee Lamb in check to, let's say, 75 yards or less, that is a massive win for a Baylor Bears team that just wants to make their opponents, as you mentioned, methodically move the ball down the field. Don't give up that 40 or 50 yard home run and make the Sooners show that they can put together those prolonged drives, which is something that I'm not really sure that offense is really built around with Lincoln Riley.
No doubt about it. And I think we're going to have a little battle here on this side. I think if you are of the mindset that Baylor is a very overrated 9-0, and I think they are to a certain extent, right? And I think if you believe Oklahoma is going to be able to shred Baylor through the air efficiently, which could be a possibility, and you think last week's score is a little phony, which, you know, probably was a little bit because you did lead three different times by 21. We saw the early numbers guys go out and lay it with Oklahoma. Now that we're getting to the 10, the double digit range, let's see if that number holds. Let's see if there's a different mindset. I'm hearing that's a potential possibility. So not much for me on this game. I'm intrigued to see where it ultimately closes and who wins that battle. But I don't have much here.
Fascinating game in a number of regards, and one that I'm actually going to have to rely on you for text updates, because this will be the first Saturday all season that I won't be able to park myself in front of the multiple TV sets and keep tabs on every single game on the docket.
Schmoozing. Corporate Todd's going to be in full effect this week.
Every now and again, you have to go out there. You have to support your friends that are tying the knot. And sometimes
shake some hands, kiss some babies.
Sometimes people get married on fall Saturdays. And I know he's a listener of this podcast. He knows exactly how I feel about him choosing a Saturday in November. But we let bygones be bygones. Life moves forward. And I'll be able to watch a few at least of the early kickoffs. Won't be able to keep tabs on the stuff going on late.
There you go.
You can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there as well. And you should, if you're not already doing so, definitely be following the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. We've broken down the five biggest games on the college football week 12 schedule, but there is still one order of business. And our best bet comes to you courtesy of FoxBet, where the biggest name in sports is now the hottest name in sports betting and one of the fastest growing betting apps out there. Whatever sports you like betting on, FoxBet has you covered. You can download the app to your smartphone and check lines from absolutely anywhere. And you can place real money wagers on dozens of sporting events with the easy to use app if you're located in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. FoxBet, make the call, download the app today. Payne, college football has been a bit of a challenge for us, but I got a renewed sense of confidence and optimism that we're going to find ourselves on the right side this weekend.
Let's go to a game that we've broken down already. 3:36, the Iowa Hawkeyes. Let's go on the money line, though, minus $1.45. It'll be interesting to see. I think... Personally speaking, maybe we wait a little bit to go on this one. It's going to be interesting to see if the market can hold three.
Yeah, I'm gonna be fascinated to see. I mean, I don't know if this obviously is gonna. Well, I know it not. It's not gonna take on the same betting handle as a Super Bowl or something along those lines. But it could take on that stratification we saw last week with Alabama LSU, where the public bettor wants to bet the underdog on the money line, and the professional may try and lay a cheaper three that might become available. So as a result, you could see that money line ticking down a shade.
Yeah, and I honestly think in a game like this, with a total this low, and just kind of thinking about how Iowa's going to go about their business, a cheap money line is certainly the better way to go. So let's call it, for show purposes, money line minus 145. I do think this is one, if you're listening, and we do have a lot of professional bettors, a lot of guys who treat this as more than a hobby, and you do have an odd screen, I would play the monitoring game of this. But for show purpose, we'll call it Iowa money line minus $1.45. Let's get the Hawkeyes to the window. And we broke this game down, I think, for about 18 minutes already. So if you're someone that, and that's fine if you are, just kind of fast forwarding to the best bet section, since we nicely display the timestamp. If you want to hear the breakdown, it's the first game that we broke down, in the second.
I don't know, Payne. You have the Vegas rotation in front of you. Why don't you tell me second. If it was the first or
it
second game we broke down?
Second. Yes, second game. All right, let's get the hell out of Dodge here.
All right, we've had enough for today. For Payne Insider, follow him on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. Follow me there at Todd Furman. Of course, the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. As always, the best bet brought to you courtesy of Fox Bet, the biggest, fastest growing sports betting app out there. Iowa Hawkeyes, Saturday afternoon, Kinnick Stadium. We'll hope that they keep their hex over the Minnesota Golden Gophers. And for yet another week, we see a team knocked from the ranks of the unbeaten. Holding a Hawkeyes money line ticket in your hand Saturday afternoon, we'll see you at the window.